Good afternoon. I'm Don Langfort, Thomas Aquinas Reynolds Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law Center and host of the Fireside Chats of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society this year. Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society is a nonprofit organization separate from and independent of the SEC. The Society preserves and shares the history and historic records of the SEC and of the securities industry through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. Today's chat will be preserved in the museum so you can listen to the discussion or read the transcript later. Today's fireside chat looks at business recovery requirements for clearance and settlement organizations in light of September 11, 2001. Our panelists today are Donald F. Donahue, Chief Operating Officer for the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, President and Chief Operating Officer of two of DTCC's operating subsidiaries, Depository Trust Company and National Securities Clearing Corporation, and Richard B. Nissen, Managing Director and General Counsel of the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation. This chat is made possible through the support of the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation. The remarks made today are solely those of the speakers and not representative of the society. Our speakers cannot give legal or investment advice. Thank you to the museum visitors for listening, and thank you, too, for coming today. We're going to talk about two roles, really, that DTCC has played in business continuity planning after September 11th. First, its role as an innovator in moving forward the state of the art on continuity planning. In addition, Donald Donahue is sector coordinator for banking and finance of the Financial Services Sector Coordinating Council for Critical Infrastructure Protection. And in that public role is helping move the industry as a whole forward in its business continuity planning. Let's start out by talking a little bit for listeners who don't know about the process of clearing and settlement. If we're going to make some estimation of what the social consequences are of loss of data, I guess we should know something about what that data is and DTCC's role in the process. So explain a little about what DTCC does and what kind of information we're talking about the need to preserve.
Okay, let me take a whack at that one. DTCC, and we're going to have to use a number of acronyms here, was established in 1999 as the holding company for DTC, the depository, and NSCC, National Securities Clearing Corporation, both of which are registered with the SEC as clearing agencies under Section 17A of the Exchange Act. In 2002, the predecessors to what became Fixed Income Clearing Corporation, FICC, as well as the Emerging Markets Clearing Corporation, known as EMCC, both of which are also registered clearing agencies, became subsidiaries of DTCC. Generally speaking, DTCC, through these clearing agency subsidiaries as well as non-clearing agency subsidiaries, provides post-trade clearance and settlement for transactions in U.S. equities, corporate and municipal bonds, government and mortgage-backed securities, money market instruments, over-the-counter credit derivatives, and emerging market debt. DTC, the depository, also provides custody and asset servicing for more than 2 million securities issues that are on deposit with us, has custody of securities with a market value in excess of $23 trillion. Finally, DTCC is a leading processor of mutual fund and insurance transactions, linking funds and insurance carriers with distribution networks. We have operating facilities in a number of locations in the U.S. as well as overseas, and have about, 2,300 employees or so?
2,600,
sorry. So that's generally what DTC is, and obviously the central role that we have in the processing of post-trade processing of securities transactions in the U.S.
And what kind of market share of the clearance and settlement process does DTCC control?
Somewhere north of 99% of the securities that we have eligible. Obviously, the other big securities market in the States is the U.S. Treasury market and federal agency and government-sponsored enterprise securities. which are settled through the national book entry system offered by the Federal Reserve. But setting those issues aside, you essentially can assume that everything else flows through one of DTCC's subsidiaries.
And on a given day, and since we're in a minute going to be talking about disasters that might befall the markets, on a given day, what kind of information is flowing through DTCC that it needs to capture and hold secure?
Well, you have market data coming off the markets that are flowing into NSCC, which is the clearing subsidiary. And you have settlement data flowing between NSCC and DTC, which is the depository, and much data flowing directly into DTC. So, for example, DTC, the depository, is going to be settling somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 billion worth of transactions on a given day. In 2003, across all of DTCC's subsidiaries, which would include clearing for Fedwire eligibles, we processed about 926 trillion, that is trillion with a T, trillion dollars worth of transactions either through the clearing mode or through clearing and settlement, both.
Now, does DTCC or any of its subsidiaries play a financial role in the settlement process, taking on any financial or credit risk?
Well, other than with respect to our own participants have an obligation at the end of the day, if they are in a debit position, to pay that those monies over to either NSCC or DTC or one of the other clearing agencies that I mentioned. So we are taking, we do have a credit exposure with respect to our own participants.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that we pay a lot of attention to managing.
Sure. Now let's turn to, obviously, the topic that we're focusing on. September 11th was a tragedy in a number of respects. It certainly had a big impact on the financial services industry, and I guess brought home the potential risks in this area for with respect to a loss of continuity in the financial services market. Give us a sense, and I think this is going to underscore just about everything we talk about this afternoon, of what the risks are of losing continuity in the securities industry.
Well, I think it's very important to understand first that business continuity was not an issue that was born, you know, at 9:08 on the morning of September 11, 2001. This was an issue that everyone in the industry was very mindful of. People had done quite a bit of work in preparing their own organizations to deal with the business continuity issues that were foreseeable, and certainly DTC and NSCC both in the 90s spent a considerable amount of time addressing that issue. DTC, for example, created two backup data centers during that decade. We had one near in, and then as technology improved, we moved it further out. So it is an issue that everyone was very aware of. What happened was that the paradigm, if you want to use that word, that people had in mind was much more what happens if something happens to me, and what happens if something happens to the building I am in. What happens if something happens to my data center? There's a fire in my data center and I get knocked out. How do I deal with that? People did not think in terms of what happens if a very, very large event happens that impacts a community, the financial services community. How do you address that issue, those issues? You know, the paradigm, September 10th, 2001, when something happened, in your primary facility, you moved to your backup facility, and everybody just basically picked up and walked across the street or whatever it was and resumed their activity in their backup site. And, of course, on September 11th, it became very, very clear that, that was not something that worked in the new world, that you can't assume you're going to be able to move people. You can't assume that people will be able to simply resume business activities. They may have to evacuate a site and may be unable to conduct their activities. And it was those things that really kind of changed how people thought about the issue entirely.
Describe a little bit about September 11th in terms of DTCC or DTC's continuity and other key players. The industry did pretty well given the challenge that it faced on September 11th?
Well, again, I can answer for both DTCC as an organization and perhaps for the larger industry. DTCC is incredibly proud. Our people are incredibly proud of the reality that we never missed a beat that day. We were very clear seconds after, you know, the impact of the second plane, as everybody was certainly, you know, reeling from what they had just seen. But there was never any question in our organization or among our people that we were going to have to keep going. We were going to have to proceed to a normal, or as normal as possible, a settlement process that day, and we were going to have to keep doing what it was that we were responsible for doing. And in reality, throughout that week and all the pandemonium and chaos of that week, DTCC and its subsidiaries kept going and kept processing in as normal a fashion as we possibly could. And we, in the equity subsidiaries in DTC and NSCC, we settled almost $2 trillion worth of transactions that week, even though the market was closed, even though many firms were forced from their facilities and so forth.
Let me just add on a personal note that we did the vast bulk of people following September 11th and September 12th went to a backup operating facility that we have in New York City, and there were people that were designated to go to such a facility in the event of 55 Water, which is our main location, being unavailable. I can say that when we came to that facility the following day, there were many, many more people than we had space for. Everybody showed up for work, and that's really the spirit that I think permeated the entire organization. We were very, very fortunate, you know, that it didn't happen to us. It could have happened to our building. It didn't, but people. People pitched in and did what they had to do, as Don said.
And I think more broadly through the industry, you saw the same, the same spirit. Obviously, you had the American Stock Exchange was forced out of its building because of the proximity to the Trade Center site. You had the New York step in and say, you know, here's part of our floor. You know, you can use that for your equity trading. I believe the Philadelphia Stock Exchange gave the Amex facilities for options trading. I mean, there was a real, you know, look, everyone is in this boat together. We are going to get through this together. And everybody understood doing that was sending a very, very strong message to, you know, the people who were behind the event that we were not going to let them get their way. So.
But it was a wake-up call, and obviously has caused a lot of thinking. Give me a sense of what the worst-case scenario is as a result of, you know, were DTC to suffer a severe loss of continuity. Well, what would the systemic effects of something like that be?
First of all, let's talk pre-9/11, okay? If your worst scenario is all of the copies of the information as to who owns what securities, those records being destroyed, that DTC, the depository, is probably the principal shareholder of pretty much every publicly traded company in the United States. And if you lose those records of who owns what, I mean, you can easily imagine the kind of pandemonium that would result from that you lose complete track of how much of IBM, to use a name, is owned by whom. And obviously, the arrangements in the United States, there is a very layered chain of who owns what, but if you lose the central core of who owns what, which is what DTC represents, you know, there would be an accounting nightmare that would take, you know, months to resolve, if it were even resolvable. Once you get past that point, then obviously you have all of the records of who transacted how now would be the last 3 days' worth of trades that DTCC's subsidiaries, NSCC in this case, would have records of for equity securities. The Fixed Income Clearing Corporation would have records up for government and agency securities. if you lose control of that, there are obviously hundreds of billions of dollars worth of transactions that now no one has a record of, and no one knows who was obligated to deliver what to whom, what the terms of that obligation are, what the payments are that go back the other way in terms of transactors and so forth. And then obviously there are all kinds of other effects.
Would that be data that could be recreated by accessing broker dealer firms, the exchanges themselves?
Well, it's kind of, you know, if you drop a mercury thermometer and it smashes and the mercury splatters all over the floor, can you get it back together? Yeah, right? Is it easy to do that? And can you be assured that you get it all back together? Obviously not. And it's the same kind of thing. Is it doable? Yes, it's doable. But you're assuming an infinite amount of time. You're assuming an infinite amount of resources. It would be unbelievably nightmarish to try.
Not in real time.
Right. Oh, no way. No way.
So I suspect, just from what you were talking about, the ripple effects on participants in the industry would also be significant. We often hear about, in banking, the potential domino effect mm-hmm. of one institution failing on any number of grounds, mm-hmm. causing others. What happens to other financial institutions
systemic
here?
Risk. Right, right. Well, one of the significant concerns you have is that DTC supports the placement and redemption of commercial paper every day, which is a big chunk of that $600 billion. And, of course, that's one-day paper. That's two-day paper. And, you know, if you lose that, you lose control of that. Obviously, how corporations conduct their short-term financing activities is in a shambles, right? Mm-hmm. The assets held in the money market accounts that many retail investors have, you know, those assets are, again, commercial paper and the like. Where are they? You know, where's my money? What kind of money? How are they invested, and how do I get my proceeds back? That would all be certainly called into question if you lose the central apparatus that supports that.
And then of course there are institutions that clearly would be affected. You're talking about customers, but mm-hmm. and I think that's what you were talking about, Don. You know, the systemic risk that would occur if an institution like DTC lost control of its records, and then of course down the line there are intermediaries, large and small, that may owe money or may be owed money, and if they don't receive their money, if they're in a credit position, they may not be able to continue in business. So that's the danger. And then, of course, you're talking about global repercussions because so many of our institutions are global in nature.
So after September 11th, there was an increased sense, as you said, continuity planning has been going on for a long time, but an increased sense that this was a priority, and it was a systemic priority. The government, the United States government, as part of its homeland security efforts, has taken steps to draw attention and develop a coordinated planning mechanism for things like continuity planning, as well as many other aspects of planning for events like this. And in October, I guess, of last year, Homeland Security issued there was an interagency paper on sound practices to strengthen the resilience of the United States financial system. I guess that's a key document mm-hmm. in the move forward to a more sophisticated plan. Describe what the interagency paper wants participants to be thinking about, what the goals are.
Well, before Don answers that question, I just want to point out that the interagency paper was a paper that was put out by the federal regulators, and it's very important to note, as we're talking about the impact of September 11th, there was an enormous impact on our regulators, and in our case, we're regulated, it seems like, by everybody, but our principal federal regulators are the Federal Reserve and the SEC, and they certainly understood, if they didn't prior to that time, the important role that that our subsidiaries had in the process, and they certainly worked with us and paid certainly a lot of attention to us and gave us certainly a lot of helpful guidance as we went forward
in terms of, you know, developing our own response to the events of September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
Well, I think we certainly, and we were not alone in this, we were out of the box within a few weeks of the events of September 11th. We presented to our board in early October of 2001, this is what we think we need to do. Okay, the paradigm shift has happened. Everyone understands it is not a one building event now. You have to really, I mean, we had the paradox that all of our planning had gone into our building being gone and everybody else is fine, and the reality was we were fine and there was chaos all around. So your whole thought process again had to shift, and we presented to our board in October, these are some of the preliminary conclusions we think we have, and I know many other firms, both infrastructure firms and individual brokerage houses and banks did the same on roughly the same timetable. The interagency white paper was really almost a compilation of what had evolved during those months following of the sense of best practices that people had evolved, and obviously with the regulator's own insights and thoughts as to how those best practices should be framed and how they should be adhered to. And essentially, the white paper correctly differentiates between the responsibilities for continuity and resiliency that what the white paper refers to as core clearing and settlement organizations, what those organizations' responsibilities are. And the second tier, if you want to use that phrasing, the white paper identified was significant firms, I believe is the terminology, where they said, okay, you are not the provider of a core service, but you are such a significant component of a particular market that your absence from that market would have a substantial effect on the ability of that market to continue to clear and settle its trades. The focus of the white paper is very much on clearance and settlement of outstanding obligations, not on preserving trading facilities right, so that future trading can take place.
Mm-hmm.
And the white paper essentially said, if you are a core clearing and settlement organization, and you know there is a very limited number of those, you have to do the following things. You have to provide for out-of-region data recovery. You have to provide for out-of-region business operations recovery, and you need to do that by this timetable. And with the significant firms, there were similar standards and a somewhat longer timetable articulated for the significant firm population. So essentially, they were saying, you know, look, this is what is viewed by the federal regulatory community as best practice, and this is what we are expecting you to adhere to in this new world, recognizing
right,
how things have changed.
And I take it one of the goals, at least that they wanted core participants to aspire to, was recovery within a two-hour period.
That's one of the standards.
Ideal
right,
circumstances.
Right. Well, that's one of the standards that is articulated for core clearing and settlement organizations. For significant firms, my recollection is 4 hours, mm-hmm, I think. And so recognizing that, you know, a DTCC as exemplary of the core clearing and settlement organizations, and there are others, but using us as the example, we would have to be able to resume business operations within 2 hours of the declaration of a disaster. And in fact, we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've demonstrated that we can do that. And other organizations would be expected to meet the same test.
Let's turn a little bit then to what DTCC has done to establish what I guess are best practices that others are following, the way it's carrying out the mission that's been assigned to it and that it's accepted. You issued a report, I guess, in February of 2004, Safe Secure Setting New Standards, a report to the industry on business continuity planning. What was it that led you to not only implement these standards but want to write a report that could influence other participants?
We wanted to, first of all, obviously we are a member-owned organization, and we are a cooperative of securities firms and bank custodians principally, And we felt that we certainly had an obligation to report to the people who rely on us for very key business activities. We had an obligation to tell them, okay, this is what we've done. This is how we have handled our responsibility, again, in this new world to give you a higher degree of resilience than was considered necessary practice, you know, in the days before September 11th of 01. So part of it was simply we're telling you what it is we know that you need to know and questions that you would have about us. I think the other driver was that a number of our members and committee members and so forth, we would be telling people bits and pieces of this, and in a number of instances they said it would be very useful for you to put that out so everybody understands the kinds of, you know, tabletop exercises you're taking on, the kinds of things that you're doing, because it would be very good for us to understand what you're doing is giving us ideas and giving us thoughts on things that we should perhaps adopt in our own firms. One of the things, again, that I think certainly we've heard comments made by people, the DTCC has been much more out in front in terms of identifying and saying what it is we're doing in terms of our own employee security issues and how employee safety is being addressed. So that's another thing we wanted to say. These are some of the things we're doing so that people could give some thought to whether they wanted to adopt a similar approach or a tailored approach that met the same needs.
Right. And we'll go through some of those specific steps in a minute. But I guess we should mention that a year ago, August, there was a disaster that I suspect not as tragic as the September 11th attack, but the power failure in the Northeast, that must have been an opportunity for the industry to test how well some of its continuity planning would work.
Absolutely, and I think we believe, and the we is the industry here, not just TTCC, that the blackout was performance in the blackout was an A plus or an A plus plus performance. I mean, it really was. You know, again, you have the 5 minutes of what's going on. You know, and trying to figure out why did the lights just go out? But after that, I think the industry generally kind of hit the ground running, and people were able to continue. And in fact, the 15th of August, which was the Friday, is a heavy payment date for principal and interest on debt securities. And so, you know, it was a high volume day from our perspective, and certainly from our members' perspective. And again, you know, it flowed through very, very smoothly as a very clear validation of all of the work that had been done for the prior almost 2 years.
I want to go through some of the best practices as you've identified them, and I'm just going to read topic headings from your report and let you talk about what you regard as particular lessons or particular practices that you think the industry needs to pay a lot of attention to, and you at DTCC have certainly paid a lot of attention to. And the first one that's highlighted in the report is one you just mentioned. It's called Protecting People and Sustaining Business Operations. Obviously, security and keeping your core team together is important for any business. Talk a little bit about the current state of thinking on protecting people and sustaining business operations.
Well, first of all, let me be very upfront. We're very clear that we think the distinction the regulatory agencies chose to make in the white paper is a very, very, very important distinction, that there are core organizations, there are significant firms, and there are other market participants, and you have different standards that apply to each. We don't believe, and we've been very clear with everyone, that the standards that are best practice for core clearing and settlement organizations might well be overkill for firms in the other categories. And you really do need to tailor what it is that you are doing and what kinds of standards you are seeking to meet to your own firm and your own position in the industry. So we're not saying a one-size-fits-all is appropriate at all. With respect to the issue of people safety, obviously there are the very, very direct issues of, you know, you're in a building that's been impacted by an incident. How do you evacuate people? How do you and how do you prepare people to deal with that issue? And certainly, I think everyone was very aware of the practice that Morgan Stanley had followed following the 93 Trade Center bombing, that they did. They were absolutely demanding of their people, you know, you will practice this. And obviously everyone, you know, we all know what our reaction is to, you know, fire drills. And they were very insistent that people had to do that. And obviously, you know, on that day, they saved thousands of people because of that persistence and that rigor. And we certainly have adopted a similar approach, and I know many other firms have as well. The issue, the paradigm shift in September 11th was that on September 10th, efficiency was sacrosanct, not that it isn't important even today. And the most efficient thing to do is to have everybody in the same place. That if you are a few floors away from each other, you are much more efficient than if you are miles away from each other. We actually had a facility outside the city that we had closed about 6 months before September 11th to bring all of those staffers in. And on that day, we had, you know, 99% of our people in the one building. And obviously, within a matter of a few hours, the horrible experience with Cantor Fitzgerald taught everybody how you know, incredibly dangerous and incredibly risky that is now in this new world. So we have, and other firms have, you know, adopted an approach now of decentralization, where we are moving significant complements of our people outside of the headquarters location. Richard noted earlier that we have a number of operating locations. And that is one of the people issues that I think many firms have adopted, that you can't have the concentration of people that we all thought was absolutely the best practice, right? The September 10th 01 best practice was to have everybody together, and obviously that is very clearly now understood to be much more risky than we thought it was.
And obviously that's a more expensive approach, and I think the management trick, and it will be it will be a trick for everybody who's in this position, is to try to manage your organization as efficiently as you had before when everybody was together, when they're not. That is going to be it's going to be a challenge.
And when you're talking about geographic dispersal, I suspect a debate in lots of organizations was, what do we mean by dispersal? How dispersed physically do you have to be? I noticed when I was reading the interagency white paper that they took pains to emphasize that they didn't want to set a mandate that you have to leave the city, leave the state, in order to create dispersal. But it must be tough to think through how far is far enough in light of the kinds of disasters that could befall. Right. Talk a little bit about that thinking and goes into to deciding how dispersed is enough.
Again, I think that question has different answers depending on who you are. And the interagency paper very, very carefully avoided the issue of, you know, is it 24 versus 48 versus, you know, 480 miles. We felt that there was no, and again, this was in October of 01, we had already understood that there was no question that we were talking, you know, a considerable distance away, both for data and for business operations recovery, that you had to be, you know, well outside the headquarters region in both of those instances. We had, as I mentioned, we had a facility in New York State that we had closed that was about 35 miles away. Within months of 9/11, we actually reopened that facility and moved people back out there. But we were also very clear, 35 miles doesn't cut it, you know.
And
we actually are about 3 weeks away from opening a business operations center that's 700-plus miles away. It is in Florida. Similarly, the data center that we created post 9/11, the third of our current data centers, is even further away than that for mm-hmm. precisely the same reasons.
Right. And your report talks about the managerial challenges that come from that, needing to rotate senior managers, mm-hmm. needing to have a contingency plan so that the expertise is there regardless of which of these operations has assumed control.
Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to thinking about distance, you're thinking about location. One of the things that we spent a lot of time thinking about was how many people are we likely to get who are going to be willing to voluntarily move to fill a job that we'll have in the new business operations center. And it was, it was critically important to us that we, that we be able to move the intellectual capital, that we not have to, create a new operations center and from the beginnings, have to train a lot of people who didn't really know our business and in particular didn't know our culture. I mean, we like a lot of business organizations, we feel that we have a particularly important culture that stresses safety and soundness and confidentiality of information. And it was very important that people who are imbued with that culture move if that were at all possible. And so we did think about that a lot as we thought about where should this location be. Should it be north of the border, south of the border, or somewhere else in the continental U.S.?
And then, obviously, geographic dispersal depends on communication. And one of the big issues that comes up here, but it's pervasive in the planning, is what happens if communication systems fail, in which case dispersal becomes a problem in and of itself. There are things core institutions can do to strengthen the security of their communication systems, but talk a little bit about both the risks of telecommunications failure and what you might do in response.
I think one of the new frontiers in this whole area of resilience, in the, we now have 3+ years under our belt, we being the financial industry, and one of the certainly was not an it was an issue that was getting attention before now, but it is an issue that I think is even looming in increasing importance, is what, the terminology is cross-sector dependencies, that the financial sector, I think, has done an outstanding job, and I believe is recognized as having done an outstanding job in dealing with its own issues and addressing its own resilience, the changes that it needs to make in its own facilities to provide a higher level of resilience. The issue now is that we are dependent on transportation systems to move our people in and out, which was the real issue in the August blackout. We are dependent on energy and power supplies, depending on who we are. Obviously, DTCC as an organization has redundant backup in spades, but we are dependent on our members. Obviously, don't have necessarily the same kind of generator capacity and so forth that we would have, and obviously they have to be able to come to the party as well. The kind of foundation stone for the sector is recognized as being telecommunications. If telecoms is blown out, there is a real question as to whether the sector can conduct business in any kind of practical way without the ability to communicate. Our communications network, the Smart Network, never went down the week of September 11th. It had been architected in a way that even though we lost several key telecommunications facilities in downtown Manhattan that day, our network survived, and we were able to continue to communicate with pretty much everybody, except for obviously the people who were in the Trade Center and in the affected buildings. We have since done quite a bit of additional work in building in additional redundancy in the network. With the implementation of our third data center, we now rotate everyone among different data centers, so everybody is live with each of them at some point during the year. Other market infrastructures have done very similar things to implement much more resilient telecommunications networks as well. The Securities Industry Automation Corporation brought live an infrastructure called the Secure Financial Transaction Infrastructure to support market activity. And all of those things have really raised the industry's level of confidence in its telecommunications resiliency, I think, to a significant degree. We are not across the finish line. There's still work that has to be done. You know, the way this works is, you know, you can know proof positive I have a completely diverse set of telecommunication circuits today. And as normal telecom provider processes work, they may choose to do something in terms of rerouting the logical paths of different circuits tomorrow, so that circuits that were in different cables running down different streets today, tomorrow get put on the same cable and run down the same street. That's an example of the kind of thing that can happen. And we have to solve the issue of how do we assure persistent diversity, and there are efforts underway to try to tackle that issue and provide such a means for critical circuits that support industry activities.
You mentioned the smart system, mm-hmm. the smart backbone. What is that?
Well, smart is the DTCC network. It is a network that we have provisioned our basic as any settlement infrastructure, any payment settlement infrastructure in the U.S. The practice that we all follow is essentially that we provide end-to-end connectivity for our users. And we know from your premises all the way into our data centers, we provision that and we know the state of that and we address any problems that arise in that. And again, the fact that we controlled all the cards, right, on September 11th and September 12th was absolutely critical because we were making decisions about how circuits were being restored. We were understanding what the nature of the problem was, and we could deal with the issue right away. It was not something where we were trying to coordinate with other people, which made a very, very big difference in terms of the timeliness of getting particular certain circuits restored or getting new connectivity established when it had to be established.
And I take it Homeland Security has given thought to how to prioritize the reestablishment of communication services.
Well, there are programs. Right. There are programs which now are in DHS. I don't remember the definition of the acronym, but there is a federal agency called the NCC, National Communications Commission, perhaps, that runs a program called the Telecommunications Service Priority Program, the TSP program. And it is NCC is now part of the Department of Homeland Security, and TSP status essentially means that you are deemed a priority telecommunication circuit, and if you are eligible under the TSP program, something happens to interrupt telecommunications connectivity, you will be given a certain level of priority in getting restoration, so that, you know, we might not have telephone service at home, but one of these circuits would have been restored because it was a TSP priority circuit. And obviously the core networks in the financial services industry we have gotten all of our circuits qualified for TSP coverage as other infrastructures have. I think there are 50 to 60,000 connections in the states that have TSP coverage now. Not all of those are financial services, obviously, but it is something the industry has utilized.
We talked about certain of the intra-sector challenges, telecommunications, transportation, power. One of the issues that comes up in your report and just about everywhere else is cyberspace. The internet, the linkages among computer systems on which we are all dependent. And there is a note in a lot of the report that suggests this is an area you think a lot more needs to be done. Talk a little bit about cybersecurity, in other words, as part of business continuity planning.
Well, again, this is pre-9/11. In the late 90s, I think actually this dates back to Gulf War I, there was a recognition that a tactic that you could use to disrupt an enemy's activity, whatever that activity might be, would be to attack the technology, the information technology infrastructure that supported that activity. And the rumor is that we actually did that in 1991 in connection with Gulf War I. And certainly, based on that experience, I think the folks in the government in the mid-90s realized, wait a minute, if information technology is a vulnerability, there is no society in the world that is more vulnerable to attack through that means than the United States. And in the late 90s, that was really the genesis of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Program at the government level, which now obviously has flowed into DHS. And it was very focused on cyber vulnerabilities and the whole issue of protecting cyberspace. The difficulty, obviously, is that information technology is relatively a new technology. We don't understand the vulnerabilities in cyberspace the way we understand the vulnerabilities in physical space. Okay, I mean, financial services resilience to physical vulnerabilities dates back to Jesse James and I'm sure before. Cyber vulnerabilities are something that are much, much newer. I think that we have gotten very focused on how we protect ourselves. We have climbed the wall of sophistication in understanding how to secure our technology environments very, very quickly. But the problem is, you have a constantly moving opponent, and the people who choose to use cyberspace to conduct malicious activities, put a lot of energy into that, are very, very creative people. And clearly we've seen the evolution of new ways of using cyberspace to attack financial services in ways that are, you're constantly chasing this to keep up with it. Mm-hmm. The central infrastructure, because of the nature of how we connect to our members, the nature of the networks that we use, is, I think, much more resilient to those kinds of attacks than, the providers of retail financial capabilities, simply because, retail capabilities are often out on open networks. They're on the Internet, whereas the core infrastructures generally are not. But certainly it's an issue that's going to bear continued focus, real work between the sector and the information technology sector, because we need the information technology providers to do a dramatically better job of securing the technology that they are providing right out of the box. Mm-hmm. And certainly they've gotten that message. I'm not implying that they're indifferent to that need. But it is something that's going to be a continued need continued focus, because it's quite a challenging mm-hmm. race that we're in.
And is that part of, is the financial services industry collectively working on interfacing with the software industry?
There's a whole host of activities that are going on. There is an organization called the Financial Services Information Sharing and Analysis Center, the FSISAC, which actually grew out of these infrastructure protection activities that began in the 90s. It's something that's very live today. And it's kind of a warning network, among many other things, for firms in terms of cyber issues and physical vulnerability issues, for that matter, as well. You have a lot of trade associations that are addressing these issues. A lot of work has been done to articulate security certification standards that people are expected to have. You need someone who's got a CISSP qualification, for example. So that you are dealing with these things in a more sophisticated way. And it's mm-hmm. not just you flip the on switch and you're online. People understand that you have to have a much higher level of sophistication in how you deal with this.
Let's turn back to your report and just some of the other best practices that are emerging. The The third section of the report is called Managing Through a Crisis, and deals with how an institution, a core institution or other, responds. How has thinking evolved in that subject area?
Well, I think, again, one of the things that we've done, maybe I can illustrate it by just giving you an example. One of the things that we've embarked on is that we have a periodic program of tabletop exercises where a scenario is presented to a management team. And essentially, well, let's assume November 11th of 2004 is the day an incident occurs, okay? Who's affected by the incident? Who is in the office? Who's not in the office? Richard and I are not in the office today. Okay, so in this tabletop, we would now become, okay, it's almost, people jokingly refer to it as the DTCC version of Survivor, okay? You're the people who are going to be running the company. Okay, what are you going to do? This is the situation you're presented with. How are you going to address this? What are your first steps? What are your second steps? And people have essentially been put through drills as to how they would deal with a crisis. And certainly you're seeing a lot more exercising of that kind of capability than you might have seen prior to September 11th. The unthinkable that people are confronted with is, look, let's assume the senior management team is largely gone. Something happens and we do not survive. Then you go to your second level managers or your third level managers. Okay, you are now responsible for running the company. What are you going to do? And what do you need? And what do we need to create beforehand so that you've got the knowledge or the guidance that you're going to need to really be able to address those issues? Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of exercise is certainly something that's now become a phenomenon of the new world. And again, DTCC does that. Many other firms are doing that kind of thing as well.
And as you talked about before, one of the profound issues with respect to clearing and settlement and many other aspects of financial services is the interconnectivity among firms. You talk about a tabletop or planning scenario that DTCC does that extend to coordination with other firms, and how do you go about making real the practice and planning for dealing with your customers and dealing with all the other participants in this business?
Well, there are several pieces to that issue. I mean, we do have a program that essentially requires our principal users once a year. They have to do an ACNAC check from their own backup data center to our network, so that we know those communication channels are in place. Industry organizations, the Securities Industry Association, the Futures Industry Association, some of the banking organizations, the Bond Market Association, all have business continuity committees. They have exercises of their own. The Bond Market Association and the SIA in May conducted a tabletop somewhat akin to the one I just described that we had done, to again take principal leaders from the major firms and run them through a scenario and, okay, what would you do? How would you handle this? Futures Industry Association a month ago conducted an industry-wide connectivity check and backup sort of rehearsal among the major futures firms and the futures markets, so that people were connecting from backup centers to the markets backup centers and checking those things out and simulating what they would do in an emergency. I know SIA is talking about a similar exercise in the securities industry for some time in 2005, so people are doing those kinds of things as well. And then, of course, you have the you have the blackout that comes along that gives you an exercise you didn't realize you had scheduled. So,
your report ends with business continuity release 3.0, which I guess is your way of looking to the future a little bit on the issues that may need more work.
Right.
We talked about cybersecurity. What are some of the other things that you'd identify as a priority for continued effort?
Well, I think we certainly also have the inter-sector dependency issues, and we've covered the key ones, the four key ones. There is clearly a need to have a more productive and fruitful working relationship between the public sector entities that are involved in this space and the private sector entities. And I think there's a recognition of that on both sides. I think that, you know, old habits die hard. You know, the folks involved in this are very clear. There's a partnership between private and public sector, and it needs to be a partnership. It needs to be a two-way partnership where each entity is bringing something to the table, which is something that we need to see evolve.
Was that the FSSCC?
Well,
the
Financial Services Center Coordinating Council is something that was created in response to the designation of the Department of the Treasury as having principal responsibility for financial services in terms of infrastructure protection. All of these things are a mouthful. And it is really a vehicle. It faces off against an organization called the Finance and Banking Information Infrastructure Committee, called FIBIC, which is the public sector side. And it is, again, an embodiment of the kind of partnership mm-hmm. that we're talking about.
So on other matters, what about cross-border?
Well, that's the last item that we felt, you know, needs to be in business continuity 3.0. You know, the markets are, Richard said this earlier, the markets are very interconnected. It was fascinating. I was at a conference a year ago of cross-border financial or multinational financial institutions, and it was very, very clear. This was two months after the lockout, and it was a very clear message coming from the Europeans and from the Asians. You know, guys, don't forget us, right? We needed to know what you were doing in August, and we don't have channels that really give us access to the kinds of decisions that you're making and understanding what your plans are. Certainly that kind of how do we build the communications links so that all members of the markets know what's going on in particular market nodes. Obviously, there's nothing that says the next event is going to be in the U.S. Very easily could be in London. And obviously, the U.S. financial market would need to know what's happening in its London counterparts. And working those arrangements out are certainly something that's going to have to happen in the near term to make sure that all works as well.
And is there any formal process underway to make that happen?
Well, there are several. Certainly, you know, our colleagues around the world, we share information and have dialogue with. We have a conference coming up next April where I'm sure this will be on the agenda. I know the central banks have been interacting with each other on this issue. The SWIFT banking collective in Belgium, I know, addresses this issue and has an active resilience advisory capability. So there are a number of things underway, yes.
Okay, I think we have come to the end of our time for today. Thank you, Don and Richard, for discussion of clearing and settlement and business continuity planning. So one again to thank the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation for making today's chat possible. Just a reminder, today's chat is now archived in the Society's Virtual Museum, so you can listen again to the discussion or read the transcript later on. Another reminder, the Society has a survey for listeners to today's chat and visitors to the museum and archive. To access the survey, please click the button just above today's chat button. We appreciate your input. This has been the final Fireside Chat for 2004. The chats will resume next year with Teresa Gabaldon, Carvel Dickinson Benson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law, as moderator. The first chat in 2005 will be on shareholder rights with Nell Minow of the Corporate Library. Tune in on Tuesday, February 15th at 3:00 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thanks for joining us today.